So good afternoon, everyone. I'm Emily Wright from EG, and welcome to this roundtable here at LREF on digital connectivity. So they say that the quickest way to get to know someone is to put them on a slow internet connection and see what happens. Sort of a modern insight into our modern psyches, but ultimately all linked to our long-standing human instinct to avoid unnecessary frustration. So what happens when we're trying to maintain that fast, efficient connection on city and even global scales? It's a very big job. And we are joined today at this roundtable by a brilliant group of people who are going to look into this on a wider scale as we delve into digital connectivity in buildings and cities across the world and ask, you know, what does it mean? Why is it important? Who is responsible for delivering it? And much more. So let's start with a quick run around the table. If everyone could introduce themselves, who you are, where you're from, and deliver sort of a very brief line or two on what digital connectivity today means to you. And let's start with you, Andy.
So Andy Pyle from KPMG. I think in the context of cities, for me, digital connectivity is just about making people's experience in cities better, more seamless, more efficient, and having that happen regardless of where they are in the city.
John Gravett from Cluttons. From my perspective, it's more about getting the built environment ready and fit for purpose going forward, making sure that the people using the buildings can actually use them properly, be that residential or that all commercial.
Belinda Fawcett from CTIL. Digital connectivity for me is having ubiquitous coverage in all our major cities, being leading the way in the world, not just in Europe, and giving great coverage, great 4G and 5G connectivity.
Vanessa Butts, I'm the CEO and co-founder of District Technologies, a tenant engagement app or a smart building app that we sell to real estate owners. And so for us, or for me, I guess it starts with smart buildings and then smart cities, and that's really the core of it. And I believe connectivity or access to digital and the internet should be a basic human right.
Hello, I'm Paul Carson from Virgin Media. Digital connectivity for me is about ensuring that the major pipelines, data transfer and so on, are available for future developments that will allow a smart city to evolve as such. Without the pipes, I think we might have a problem.
Good afternoon, Anthony Schober, Kell Computing, delivering valuation and analysis software to the real estate industry. Digital connectivity to me is really the future of commerce and really enabling us to run a more efficient way of conducting business throughout both our cities and within a global platform as well.
Hi, I'm William Newton from Wired School. For me, digital connectivity is the lifeblood of modern business. It's the enabler of much of what we want to do in the world and is only ever going to get more important.
Hi, I'm Tripti from Travtis, the home of Adam.
A very London introduction there.
That is true. It's sirens come on when I speak. Well, on that note, digital connectivity for us at Travtis is essential.
Essential. Well, I'm not surprised to hear that, and it's great that you feel that, and I'm sure that everybody around the table would agree with that. I'm gonna start things off. I'm going back to you, Andy, actually. So KPMG's global infrastructure chairman recently said that when building new transport corridors in cities now, we should be thinking about what might replace present day technology in the future. When designing and developing new high speed train lines, for example, we should also be thinking about how we would use the same land and space to accommodate a Hyperloop or maybe drone corridor. And that idea of looking at what's happening and what's being delivered and thinking about things for the future that we could put in there. And that also, I think, does apply to the elements that are required for digital connectivity. So what are your thoughts on that and planning that little bit further ahead for the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think that future-proofing real estate assets and development is actually one of the big challenges that the industry faces. If you look at how fast things are changing in more consumer-facing businesses, you know, we go back 5 years, we did not really have WeWork in London. You know, a bit further, Airbnb did not exist. So things are actually moving incredibly quickly. And it's a big challenge for real estate investors and developers, or for government putting in infrastructure, because you actually have to think forward in decades when actually the underlying needs of the users of the property or the infrastructure could be changing a lot more quickly. So it's both fundamentally important and also incredibly difficult to do when you're starting to think about capital allocations. I think the more that you can design in flexibility and actually think further forward, so in the context of mobile, you know, when you were putting in 4G, also trying to have an understanding of how you might then move forward when you get into 5G, etc. I think is you just have to do as much of that as you can.
And John, your thoughts on picking up on that element of, you know, the idea of it being so crucial to design forwards and future proof, but then the challenges that there are coming up against that at the same time, how do they get overcome?
Well, you overcome those just by trying to be practical. I think we only know what you know at the moment in time. You don't know what you don't know. So, you know, we know 5G is coming. We know they designed some sort of opportunities for that. We know what we're doing on fibre. We know the fixed line connections and what cabinets we have. So we need to just work within those means and make sure we have a little bit of scale, a little bit of depth behind that as well. So it's just about being, you know, being streetwise with the knowledge that we have to use it effectively.
And William, what are you noticing from your side of the equation in terms of how quickly and how efficiently this need to design for the future is being taken up by the real estate sector?
I think the last 2 years have been remarkable in the response of the sector to the changing needs of tenants. 2-3 years ago, this wasn't a conversation in anything like it is the same way today. And I think the real estate community should actually be commended in large parts for having recognised how much this changes things. To pick on just one technological shift that's probably caused this from the tenant side, if you look at now the increased use of the cloud and the need of people to be able to upload at around about the same speed they need to download, it's, you know, shifted an enormous tenant behavior. And landlords have responded to this, and they've responded well to this by starting to think both about how they can build better buildings and how they can retrofit their existing stock to be fit for the modern world.
And Paul, kind of the same question to you really, but from your perspective, you know, that need and requirement not only to think about the future, but to think about the future beyond the future. How have you approached that?
Well, I think we've enjoyed being at the within VM anyway, and at the front edge of speeds and so on with the delivery through our networks. But that's sort of kind of old technology, really, with the copper based in various forms. Now we've moved into the fibre realm. I think the fibre will be able to support the sort of data transfer needs that we might have in the foreseeable future, but who knows in 10 years' time. It's exponential growth. And the real concern I think we have is how on earth do we all manage to cope with the huge amount of data that will be required now, never mind when we get into the realms of autonomous vehicles and all sorts of other things that are going to happen. Data pipes are going to have to be very robust in order to support all of that. So I think it's quite key that fibre deployment is at the top of the list, really.
Anthony, you were nodding along there. Presumably that's something that you agree with?
Yeah, sure. And I think in terms of the appeal of resident of buildings throughout the cities, it makes it a lot more a differentiator of buildings to be able to be connected to these type of fibre connections to enable you to behave and operate in the most efficient way possible. And that, again, going back to the appeal of tenancies within buildings, occupiers do have choices now, and there is a lot of choice that we've got in the industry to be able to occupy a space that is fit for your needs.
I mean, there's sort of an overarching question really on how important digital connectivity is to a new generation of occupiers, and I'd be very surprised if anybody around this table said not very or average. You know, it seems like that is, you know, so important. But are there any elements of it, and I'll come to you, Vanessa, actually, any elements of it that you are sort of catching sight of and noticing that are going to be really important when it comes to rolling out citywide? And we're talking here, I suppose, about smart cities, which is something I know you're very passionate about.
Yeah, sure. I think it's, first of all, I think, yes, it's a very exponential big change ahead of us in the next 10 years. I think buildings and cities will change a lot, but there's much we can do today. So I think sometimes we get overwhelmed with trying to do everything at once, and actually we can start with baby steps. And something we try and encourage our clients to do is start with a pilot, you know, start with one building and then do 3 and then do 9 and then, you know, maybe 20 at once. So you can really do a lot to start today. And in terms of smart cities, there's some fantastic friends of mine or other startup companies that are actually tackling some really innovative problems today, like Duncan with Skyport. They're renting the roofs of high towers for drone landing platforms and flying cars, potentially. Who knows when that will happen in London, but there's a lot of really interesting projects going on today that owners can sort of get their hands dirty with. And it doesn't, and I think a lot of it goes back to maybe adopting some of the startup mentality that risk and failure is positive, but we need to fail fast. So let's try things, experiment, and then move on and take the learnings to improve our buildings and to improve our cities.
It's interesting you say that, because I wanted to actually touch on failure. It's one of my favorite things, not to do it, but yeah, to discuss it, because I think it is so important when it comes to tech and actually real estate and digital connectivity. So I'm keen to come back to that. But for now, Belinda, could I just ask you, we've talked about, you know, looking ahead and then looking beyond ahead. And we've touched on smart cities. I'm sure we'll say a lot more about that. But in terms of London, we're here today in London. How do you think London sits on that scale of, you know, smart city and the digital connectivity plans for the future?
So I mean, it's interesting hearing everyone around this table and talking about real estate, and I think London's got a long way to go. I'm going to be probably fairly controversial here,
and we
talk about the real estate business. Paul, you talked about fibre. What everyone has to remember, I mean, we're one of the largest infrastructure provider for mobile. We've got over 25,000 sites across the UK. And in order to deliver that mobile coverage that everyone wants, 4G, 5G, we need sites. And what we need is we need the landlords, we need developers, we need the real estate market to support and help us to do that. And I'm not sure that they are yet in that place. And we've been working really hard over the last 2 years. The government have introduced new legislation and we're not there yet. So it's still very much, you know, the old school real estate. But we cannot do this. We cannot give all you guys around this table who, you know, have some great ideas, you know, the drones landing on the roofs. Those can only work if you get great 4G, 5G coverage. And that's what we're here to do. And so we need the London real estate developers, landowners, we need them to support us and help us in that.
When you say there's a long way to go, I'd be interested to know if there's anywhere else around the world that you sort of look at and cover in terms of that relationship. Is there anywhere that's doing this very well, where the real estate sector is more on the same page, or is this just a property, a sort of a global issue that the real estate sector just across the world is still not quite there in terms of delivering what needs to be delivered for you to deliver what you need to deliver?
So, I mean, I think the UK is quite behind the curve in this respect. I think a lot of other countries, you look at somewhere like New York, I mean, you look at America, and I know a lot of the local authorities in some of the US states or some of the state departments, they will actually say, they will determine, well, you will be able to get a site for X amount of money, and that's it, and you will deliver it in 6 weeks. It takes us years, it takes us months sometimes, years, months to actually deliver a site, to deliver that mobile coverage. So I think the rest of Europe is all also far more advanced than the UK is. I mean, when London is not even in the top 20 in terms of digital connectivity and coverage in Europe. And that's really poor.
It is really poor. I think at this point, William, I know you're leaning forward to the microphone to say something, and so go ahead. But also anyone else that wants to come in on this, because there are some great points there that, you know, quite sobering points that probably need to be addressed. And who better to address them than you guys? So,
well, I think I wanted to take one point that Belinda made, which I think actually builds on what John was saying, which is about future technologies. And it's something that we all need to remember, because it's a great myth that I think people who don't spend as much time as we do think about this, which is that we're going to have lots of wireless technologies in the future, so everything's going to be fine. You know, we're going to be beaming satellite-based internet down, and that's going to be the main source that we use. And 4G and 5G are going to be wonderful, because we can walk around with our laptops anywhere. And as John said earlier, to get that right, We actually need to build lots and lots of base infrastructure everywhere. So for the 5G rollout across London, we're going to need somewhere between 100 and 500,000 small cell sites, depending on whose estimate you take. Because when it comes down to it, 95% of any wireless technology is actually wires. You're actually bringing fiber to a point, and then you're using that as the distribution point. And increasingly, because we're using high frequency technologies like 5G, you're not actually going to be able to transmit the data as far, even though you're going to be able to transmit it at a far faster speed. So as much as the future is going to be wonderful and our experience of it should be seamless and wireless, it's actually going to rely on a huge amount of base infrastructure, and the need for that's never going to go away.
On top of that, I mean, also what we're looking at is the fact that from an infrastructure perspective, we're not state run. We're not being sponsored. There's not going to be, you know, 200 million from the government to go and build the next generation. So it's all led by the private sector. And then from that point of view, the built environment, the landlords, developers have got to take on this cost themselves. So they just see it as a cost, OPEX, CAPEX battle. And that's where the education piece is happening now, by saying, well, actually investing in connectivity within their assets will actually drive better returns. So we're having to come from that reverse angle. Then you look at the likes of Singapore and Paris, where actually it was state funded, therefore it's all rolled from that perspective. So London's in a unique disadvantage because of it's, we're governed by legislation, but then there's no, you know, financial muscle to help drive that through.
Tripti, I want to come to you now, because I know that you've worked in countries around the world, and I wonder what you think, the areas that you've seen sort of great innovation, and where you see London on that scale.
So I don't think London's the worst. It's definitely not the best. My experiences have been in New York, Singapore, Mumbai, and London. And all four cities actually represent fairly stark contrasts. Singapore was definitely, as a city, very well connected. It has a digital strategy which exists, I think, on an infrastructural level. And it's even as simple as there's a single login for every citizen. So when I moved to London, I actually found it absolutely appalling that I needed to have five numbers, for one for HMRC, one for VAT filing, another one just to get onto the tube. The fact that in Singapore you use the same ID, what it does is it sets you up for creating context in the future, which allows you to drive to things like AI. Which I don't think London as a city has really come together to understand, because there's a lot to be done just from that basis of what if we were to actually work with a single login for citizens, period. I think the other aspect which I find really interesting is regulation. So real estate especially is often driven by regulation. You can't necessarily have a drone landing on your rooftop, because it's possible that the regulation wouldn't require it. You're still potentially getting approvals for a helipad. And similarly, you may be required to provide electricity and water, but you're not required to provide Wi-Fi. And if you are looking at the future where everything is going to be linked to sensors, I'm sure most people here know that it's actually really hard to get that data into a hub, send it through all those concrete walls, and do it in a way that is actually linked to connectivity. So Wi-Fi sometimes is not the best way to get that data out of your sensors. We know people who use radio frequency. And it sounds like old tech, but it's actually the most comfortable one, because it actually gets the data out. So there's, I think from that perspective, it does make sense to have a slightly larger plan, or a citywide plan, which involves things like regulation, which involves things like how do you look at this as a citizen experience, not just from a private enterprise experience. And then Mumbai, I have to say, was quite the opposite, because everything is private. The government isn't exactly the best one to push everything forward, and it's a country and a city that's run by Jugaad, which is go figure it out. Interestingly, no, but it's great, because interestingly, some of the greatest innovations I've actually seen were all in Mumbai. The only problem was they weren't scalable. But what
we
you
have
see,
to ask, what are those? And one of those innovations would be great.
So, for example, payments, right? So banking in India did not have the best online banking system, but there's a company like Paytm, which has completely killed the market, as we call it, with the mobile wallets. The reason for that is because it wasn't an incremental development of technology. I mean, this was a step change in technology. It was almost like an entire industry missed an entire stage of tech development, but ended up adopting the next stage instead of trying to catch up. And that's what we see in Africa, for example. You have mobile wallets, which are more popular than having debit cards. M-Pesa is like the perfect example for that. Paytm is like the M-Pesa of India. You see that in Indonesia now, where government regulation and data connectivity, everything is just linked to the fact that it's easy to have the cloud and it's easy to get Wi-Fi. So it's, I think London's somewhere in the middle.
We did a big global city benchmarking study last year, and we asked 200 cities to participate, and about 60 said yes, okay. Only 35 could actually provide us with the data, a baseline of data that we actually needed to be able to benchmark them. So when there's an interesting point here around what a smart city actually is, because there is no single global standard for what a smart city constitutes. We found many cities actually struggle to measure or obtain data to actually measure and track their own performance in terms of delivery of services and the experience of their citizens year on year, let alone actually compare, say, Mumbai to Chennai or another city in India or wherever. Undoubtedly, if you are starting greenfield, as you saw in Africa with them moving immediately to mobile and skipping past fixed, you have a big advantage in terms of actually being able to go straight to the best technology that suits you today. The challenge is in cities like London, we have firstly the unique UK challenge around land availability and the planning system, which, you know, this whole exhibition and conference around us is basically trying to grapple with the challenges of the planning system. But secondly, you've got legacy infrastructure, and you've basically got to try and make the city smart whilst also dealing with what you've got at the moment, and that's retrofitting, and it's expensive, and it's just difficult to actually do in practice. And unfortunately, lots of the planet is in that position and are just going to have to get on it. Otherwise, India, Mumbai, and cities in Vietnam or elsewhere in Asia Pacific are just going to overtake us in terms of the tech.
So, I mean, one always wonders, like, why does the infrastructure of New York, for example, look so old in comparison to all the new cities? Well, that's because it is. And the problem with the first mover advantage is just that. Like, if you're the first one who came up with the underground or the subway, and I'm not saying New York did, because the Brits will probably kill me for saying this, but the fact is that you do... Yeah, no, thank you. But what it does definitely do is it means you have to have an additional plan for maintenance of that first mover advantage. Otherwise, you have cities like Singapore, which pretty much pick up the best learnings from everyone else, put it into their plan, and then have a 30-year plan, which is linked to a maintenance going forward.
Anthony, I saw you. I saw Anthony reaching for the microphone. So if Anthony and then pass that to Vanessa, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I guess cities are no real difference to an old building. So you need to sort of look at how are we going to retrofit a city to meet the current standards and requirements we need. And London is an old city, and it does take a lot of time. And I don't think there really is any city in the world that really is a benchmark. I spent quite a lot of time out in the Middle East sort of building brand new cities, and still there was no real understanding of what we really need our city to behave like to be a smart city. So, like, even coming in on the tube this morning, I was able to use my Wi-Fi in the tube, which you weren't able to do a little while ago. So now it sort of enables me to actually work underground on my way to the office. And so how I get to the office as well, I think London has evolved over recent times. You check your Google Maps and you're able to then understand, okay, significant delays on District Line, which seems to happen every day. But you've got an understanding, and then how you can then plan your journey to enable you to get to your meeting or to get to the office in the best way possible. So I think there's an evolution that we are going through at the moment, which is quite exciting. And the cities, I guess, are starting to understand how we're going to behave in the future.
Thank you very much. Vanessa?
Thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to add, while on the topic of technology and smart cities, something I'm very passionate about, because we talk more about tech and connectivity and how essential it is, but I think, and I did a keynote on this in Berlin at the British Council for Offices, for me it's like the more connected we are online, the more disconnected we are in real life. And everything we're building, I believe technology is only an enabler. As a way of thinking about technology, we need to focus on the user experience and the human interaction in cities. So what are cities? They're our home. How can we make our homes better to live in, better to get from A to B, you know, easier to connect with people, but also more human? And I think as we become more and more smart, like Andy was saying, what's the definition of a smart city? I think we need to, my point and what I always talk about is, let's not forget the human experience.
That is an excellent point, and it was going to be my whole roundup to the session. I have it written here that Vanessa, you did that brilliant keynote and talking about how smart cities are important, but we don't want to become human robots when we're looking for human interaction. So it's a great point, and one that I'd like to come back to, actually. And I think that from everything that we're talking about, you know, that idea of sort of pushing forward digitally is so important, but it ultimately, it's what you're saying, it's to improve that human experience. Paul, I'm just going back one step to what we were discussing about where London fits. You know, somewhere in the middle, maybe, people are saying, and in terms of what that actually means for sort of driving forwards, and I suppose practically what it means for that overarching plan, which London doesn't really seem to have in terms of that digital strategy.
No surprise, probably, but I would side entirely with Belinda's points from earlier on. And I don't think London's as smart as it thinks it is. For me, a truly smart city would have a smart plan for how it deals with its legacy infrastructure. Biggest problem we have, obviously, it's nice to have competition. Everybody wants that. But to be building four or five sets of independent infrastructures just seems crazy to me. Building a new network in a city like London is difficult enough to build it once, but with four or five different companies trying to do the same thing, that just becomes almost impossible. We need to move to a position, I think, where as the infrastructure is developed, we do it once, make it flexible so that it's available for all parties that need to use it, and then we'll minimise disruption to the populace, because that's all part of the people experience in all of this. So it's not just about sort of relentless drive for more and more tech. I think it's about being smart about how we affect people in cities when we want to go about this big change.
So does that mean that you would embrace the idea of a state-owned fibre network throughout London?
It doesn't have to be state-owned. I think you could take a sort of simple example of a new development site where any developer would expect to have telecoms network in there, usually from Openreach or whatever. We would probably want to go and build a network. Sky or TalkTalk might want to do the same. So you're going to have competition, but the competition doesn't have to be three, four networks. You can build one on the site and have an interconnect point where that's where your point of competition is, because the various players can provide service to a central point. The distribution beyond that can be a single one. It doesn't have to be four. So once you've got a fibre pipe between a property and your interconnect point, any customer can move from one provider to another at the interconnect point, rather than having to have multiple independent networks, which is what's driving an awful lot of the congestion we see now. And for me, smart is about getting over that problem and being a little bit more grown up about how we go about developing it.
You've still got to deal with resilience, though,
And making sure that if you're only putting one network in, yep, you by not having three, four, five, I'm not saying five feels too many, mm-hmm, but actually there are advantages to having multiple networks in when you start looking at the resilience of buildings to challenges in one particular network.
Of course, but even now, I mean, with the mobile comms, there's still a need to have resilience and diversity from the base sites and so on. That isn't always done through the operator's own network. We use other providers for diversity in the network, and I'm sure everybody else does as well. So my point is that the hard work, which is digging up the streets and dealing with all the civils, we do once. So if we're going to dig up Bond Street, let's just dig it up once and make sure when it goes back down again, we leave it alone. And that's an ideal, but you know, if you don't seek out these things and try and go in that direction, then we just continue in chaos, which is, I think, where we are now. And for me, that's one of the main reasons why London is not as smart as it thinks it is. It's just too hard to do these things.
I think there's an example happening in Pennsylvania of there needing to be a lot of work done along one of the main roads running along the southern state border, and also connecting up the toll booths because they're not connected to each other at the moment. So there was a conversation between the contractor and a provider who said, well, we're going to do it. We're going to dig it up. Let's just put fibre in now, and then that will be it for the whole state. I mean, that seems like such a simple decision to have made. How far away are we from those kind of decisions being that simple, as simple as a conversation between two parties?
I had a conversation a little earlier today, which I don't know if people remember the adverts we had on television about the hole in the road with all the multiple services in it. And if we're going to dig it, let's do it once. I think it's all about dialogue between the parties and a longer-term plan to understand who's going to do what and where that overlaps. Almost have an enforced procedure where you have to talk to the other utilities or whoever else is going to be carrying that out and put your infrastructure in. It's almost like either you do it now or you're locked out for 10 years. And that might just focus the minds a bit.
Thank you. Vanessa?
I just have a question for the table. And I don't know if you all saw the new Smart City Mayor's London initiative with the first Chief Digital Officer, Theo Blackwell, that was launched recently. I guess my question would be, what do you all think about it?
Good question. Who wants to take that? Belinda.
Yeah, so we've been working quite closely with the GLA on that. I think it is a great initiative. I think he's certainly looking forward. I think my concern is, and I think, again, going back to Paul's point, I think we're probably both on the same page here, but one of the biggest challenges with London is you've got, 33 London boroughs? So we can go for planning. So none of us have mentioned planning on one side of the street, and you might get planning, and literally on the other side of the street, which might be another borough, you don't get the planning permission. I mean, those are the challenges that we have. So I think the mayor's initiative is great, and we, you know, certainly from a CTR perspective, we're working really closely with them, and we're trying to support that. But you know, I think it's still got a long way to go, and I think the boroughs need to work really closely together. And a few people have mentioned cooperation and collaboration and talking together, and I think that's probably the most important thing. There needs to be more discussion, there needs to be more cooperation and collaboration, and actually together we actually might create this smart city that everybody wants.
John, do you have anything to sort of add on that in terms of those, you know, I know one of the first questions I asked you was around the challenges, but just based on what we've now heard from various people around the table, from what you're hearing, do you think that there is a sort of a clear way forward that involves everybody, all parties?
Still not fully yet, no. I mean, we need to have more teeth behind the legislation and policies. You know, it's nice to have these forums being set up, but they need to have some teeth. People need to know there are consequences by not collaborating, by not having the forum, by making the people work together. So, yes, it can be collaboration amongst Virgin Media and Vodafone and whoever else, but, you know, we've got to sometimes force it upon them and say, actually, no, you need to collaborate now and dig the road up once or do whatever it is. And then from the other side, you've got the landlord perspective. Well, at the moment, they are private. Most of them are private ownership, and they're there for yield value and returns on their investments. So, you know, it's the education piece behind actually confirming actually that connectivity is going to drive better value and better returns. So we've got the disconnect between, you know, the private, you know, sector having to do a lot of the work in terms of the ownership of properties and then the infrastructure as well, with the, you know, with government just sitting on the side saying, yeah, it'd be nice if this happened, but wouldn't it be nice if London was leading the way? But you need to have that sort of bark behind it to actually make it happen.
And we've talked a lot around, you know, pretend, you know, what would be an ideal solution and how it might work, but ultimately, is there an answer when it comes to who is responsible for this? Whose responsibility is it ultimately to make sure this happens? Is it everybody's and nobody's?
What we're actually discussing is, because we're saying that there should be more communication while talking about connectivity and technology, and technology can allow you to do that. So at least what we've noticed is governments usually they're not evil. They have the right intent. The fact that New York City has created an open data API for literally everything that's out there, the fact that London wants to do that, is that there is an openness from most governments now of wanting to create a transparent at least a data mart somewhere. Where it gets stuck is actually with private enterprise. Because a lot of that data stays within those private enterprises, and there is no such thing as a service bus that connects all of our communication between different enterprises. And you could, in fact, use technology in order to make sure that this communication happens. If there was a time when tenders used to come out in newspapers, now those tenders come out online. If those tenders are now flowing directly through, you know, infrastructural service buses, which allow you to connect through all the enterprises that work with the government or do not or are related, that's actually a tech solution to creating communication, to making that happen.
Some very comedy-style microphone issues opposite the table with Andy there.
I was trying so hard not to get distracted.
I had to. I'm sorry.
Completely impervious to it.
I had to save you for it. I'm sorry, but you were making an excellent point. Please carry on. Now we've all laughed, Andy.
Well, I think I've kind of forgotten now what I was saying. But
and I think it's a great point because we can use these new technological tools to ensure better collaboration. The side point that we have, which I say as a former civil servant, is that if you start moving all of your collaboration and cooperation online, you end up missing out a whole load of your citizenry. So you need to make sure that you're actually bringing along those people who are much less comfortable with those tools. Because where you look at countries like Estonia, who are really, really good at engaging their citizens in that way, they also are really, really good at engaging their young citizens in that way, and then they lose out on a lot of the older voices. So while I totally agree with you, there is always a caveat that we need to make sure that digital inclusion is part of any policy that we put forward for tech-enabled collaboration.
Yeah, and it's important to actually allow tech to do what it can. So for example, we do have voice. I mean, if somebody knows how to pick up a phone, they should be able to utilize technology. If somebody knows how to text, they should be able to utilize technology. We won't get there till the decision makers actually recognize what's truly out there, because most of the time they're just playing catch up with old tech. So again, it kind of comes back to that step up in technology versus just incremental. As long as you're going in for a step up change, which is not let's catch up with the way things have been done before or being a follower to something. Like, for example, if London said, let's do it the way Singapore does it, that's the wrong decision, because the tools that are available to you are different from the ones that Singapore had 2 years ago or 3 years ago. So in fact, you should be able to take those decisions on a step up basis so that inclusion that really can actually come through.
I think you've got to start with the experience of the citizens and the people that are living and working and travelling through the city. And I think if I think about what is a smart city, for me it is something where data and technology is at the heart of everything that the city is doing, where technology is an enabler and used by those people running the city to fundamentally improve everybody's quality of life, deliver services more efficiently, make it easier for people to get round and get what, you know, do what they need to do, but actually, as you say, Will, to do it in a way that is inclusive to everybody. And you know, that's kind of easy to say but pretty difficult to do in practice. But again, I think you've got to start with having, as someone said earlier, an overarching plan and a strategy, and then you've got to then bring the private sector with you. And it is difficult when you have a patchwork quilt of ownership in lots of different parts of the city. And for sure, planning, you've got to deal with that. And you know, more broadly, you've got the National Infrastructure Plan and some mechanisms that government has tried to put in to deliver those projects that span planning authority boundaries. Clearly, you need something that works for that in London to deal with the sort of the boroughs effectively, where you can just get radically different answers to a question that actually is something for all of London.
Do you think that there is a danger, perhaps, that London, as an undeniable leading city and as a city that is so well known for, it is known for innovation and in terms of, you know, the ideas that stem out of companies here, it's known for being a great breeding ground for startups, for innovation as well. Do you think there's maybe a danger that because of all that, the city hasn't quite realised just how far there is to go if it wants to keep that crown? I don't know who I'm asking that to, actually.
I think that's absolutely the case. And I was listening to the Global Cities talk this morning and hearing from New York, London, Paris and Singapore, and none of them were sort of mentioning the sort of connectivity side of it. And it's one having all these in innovations and incubator, setups, etc. But, we've got to have the technology to enable them to actually breathe and develop on that. And, going back to the earlier point as well, you know, who ownership is it? Well, I think quite obviously the public realm has to be dealt with externally, but then the actual property owners have got to take account internally. And where do most of us actually do our work and conduct our activities? Actually internally, it's in the buildings. And I think there the clear ownership has to come down to the owners and the tenants actually taking ownership of what connectivity they want. And when they step outside the front door or the front door of their office, then it comes to the public realm, which is then the other utility providers.
Does anybody have any thoughts to add onto that? Otherwise, I'll move on to the next point. I've written on our sort of sheet for today, I've written failure, which is absolutely nothing to do with the actual session itself, but to remind me to come back to that. Vanessa, you mentioned it. Tripti, you mentioned it just earlier this week at our Tech Live event. We've been looking into it at EG. It was mentioned on a panel that we hosted that William was part of at MIPIM. It keeps on cropping up, and Andy, of course, keeps on cropping up this idea of failure. And by that, of course, we don't mean failure in those terms. It means getting things wrong and trying again, and that being part of innovation. So, Vanessa, if I could start with you, because you brought it up earlier. How does this sector, the real estate sector, and by default, so the world of connectivity, how do we get better at failing to learn from our mistakes?
Yeah, I think it's a really great point and something where we see all the time. And I would say, if I may, I don't think he'll be upset that I quote him, but James Goldsmith from AXA said it to me in the best possible way. He said, Vanessa, we're used to making decisions as in the real estate industry that take us 3 years to make that last 30 for buildings, because of course you build assets that are that in German the word real estate, Immobilien, literally translated means non-movable asset. And that's true. And so actually we need to separate, I think, in terms of real estate, the concept of developing buildings and trying out software, which can be done in, like, we build our software in weekly and two-weekly sprints. So every week and every 2 weeks, we're updating new features. And that actually can be tested. You can test things for a month or two, and you're not tied in. Of course, there's some implications with your operations. And if it's a customer-facing app, then you want to make the right decision to roll that out to your customers. But ultimately, I think the concept of failing fast from startups is, even, like, earlier when we mentioned it, You said something that I thought was quite funny. You were like, you know, we should fail fast, but not fail. But actually, failing is not a bad word. I think people still have this risk aversion around the whole concept of failing, that, you know, trying something and it not working out is failure. But actually, it can be a huge success because, you know, you can fail 10 times and get the 11th one right, and you would have never gotten there without the 10 failures. And I think on average, even for founders, like I think there's a study by Y Combinator, the most successful founders are successful on their fourth or fifth company on average. So you don't always get things right, but it leads you up to doing things in the best possible way. And just testing things, doing pilots, like taking different parts of your portfolio to look at different opportunities is the way that we always encourage innovation to be driven. And if you don't try things, you'll never learn.
Tripti, I know that you brought up some excellent points on failure and how important that is a couple of days ago. How do you think that sort of plays into what we've been talking about today?
Well, I think we do say that real estate doesn't like to fail, but we actually started off as a fairly innovative industry. It's called, we used to have a master builder way back in the 1400s, and there's nothing more iterative than the master building approach towards building. The Gothic cathedrals exist simply because there was design and build in its truest form. And in fact, when we do technology, I always tell, because I come from an architecture background, I always tell our coders, this is design and build. That's exactly how it is. We're coming up with the idea. We're going to test it. We're going to iterate. It's going to work or it's not going to work. But you do it really quickly. That's exactly how all the Gothic cathedrals were built. But what happened was the time value of money crept in at some point, and the DCF analysis then made us extremely risk averse. And that's basically what's happened to the real estate industry. I mean, I would say we just need to go back to our roots. We're an industry who used to take a lot of risk and in fact used to iterate a lot. We just need to find that again. And it's not failure. And again, even with our team, we say this all the time. They'd come and say, oh, I'm sorry, it didn't happen in the sprint. We came across this problem. I said, that's not a failure. We just iterated. We figured something out and we're going to do the next iteration. And if something's existing and available to send out to the market and we think that this is something we can apply our brand to, let's send it out. If we don't think that, we continue iterating. And it's never going to be complete. There's not a single software project out there that is ever complete. Tesla is still work in progress. Facebook is still work in progress. Google is still work in progress. Everyone's work in progress. So you don't think of it as failure. You really think of it as iteration. But you have to allow people to iterate. And that's how we would define failure.
Can I just add, because I thought that was a brilliant point. I think the best, most innovative owners are going to start looking at buildings, you know, iteratively and not in a relationship way. So I can test things in the same building without having to wait. You know, I build something, I lease it out. Maybe it's a 20-year lease, but that doesn't mean that I then go away for 20 years and don't speak to my tenant again. It's actually the opposite. I think the most innovative ones are seeing it as a service design-led, relationship-driven contact with the tenant that can be, you know, monthly.
Hope, to be honest, is that the industry stops using the phrases landlord and tenant, because I just think that is inherently confrontational. Once the industry starts becoming more focused on customers, and not just customers but the users of buildings as well, because those two things will be different in almost all circumstances, then I think we'll start to move a lot further forward, because ultimately this stuff is going to come down to customer demand. So when KPMG would now be going and looking into a new building, you know, having digital connectivity as well as transport connectivity is incredibly important to us. You know, I don't know if we are now insisting on having a wired score, because actually the last time we moved offices, you guys weren't really doing it. But actually, I think increasingly customers of the industry will require to have things like some form of verification on it, and then that's going to drive a whole bunch of behavior for the industry, because it will come down to, I can either get a customer into this building if it is good enough, and if it isn't, I need to iterate it.
We have 1 minute left, actually, so what I wanted to do is just to go round the table and get some final thoughts from everybody. And somebody mentioned throughout the course of this session, which has been brilliant, that what we need to focus on, amongst other things, is, you know, what do we really need? So if it's okay, I'd like everybody to just sort of finish up by saying what you think it is that we really need when it comes to digital connectivity. And I know that everybody's sitting there thinking, please don't ask me first. Andy.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
I think in one word, more digital connectivity. We cannot have too much of it.
John. Following on that theme, more guidance and more forums of communication to actually increase the understanding of the property community, really.
Belinda.
Apart from a microphone, more mobile infrastructure. We absolutely have to have the ability, and we need to be supported to roll that out, to deliver whatever it is. We can look to the future, but actually it's what we need now.
I would say collaboration between government, technology companies, and real estate owners. So encouraging these large-scale projects to actually happen faster.
Thank you. Paul?
Well, I agree with all of the comments made before, but I think my plea would be for a bit of common sense to be applied, and let's go in steps that are actually manageable and not try and take steps that are far too big and then we end up failing and have to iterate multiple times. So slow start, get it right, and then accelerate. That's usually the best way.
Thank you. Anthony?
Yeah, likewise, agree with everyone's comments, and probably also collaboration and communication amongst sort of different parties, including their developers, to share ideas and initiatives amongst the industry.
I'll go with ownership and mindfulness. You know, I think I embrace the fact that we live in a country, unlike some countries who may have an easier way of planning things and paying for them centrally, because they're in autocracies. I think the fact that we have a vibrant private sector is a good thing, but we need to make sure, as Vanessa said, that all the parts, you know, the government, the landlords and the tenants and the telecommunication providers all understand that this is something they need to contribute to. And you know, maybe that means that the property sector needs to really understand they need to be putting telecommunications telecommunications equipment on their roofs to facilitate a great experience for everyone in the macro environment. But everyone needs to know that they own this issue and that we all need to think about it. And we just need to be mindful in the way that we do that. We need to be mindful in the way that we build buildings, we refurbish buildings, we fit out buildings. We need to be really thoughtful about this. And the more thoughtful the landlord is and everyone in the community is, the better experience for people, the more human we end up being.
Thank you very much. And finally, Tripti.
I think we need more dreamers so that there would be more use of that connectivity. So I think a little more imagination would be lovely.
Brilliant. What a great note to end on. Thank you all so much for joining us here today. And here's to a future of more.